Hello, and welcome to the July 2013 IFRS Interpretations Committee podcast. My name is Michael Stewart, Director of Implementation Activities at the ISB, and I'm joined by three members of staff, Liz Figge, Leon Piombino, and Patrick Laflau, to talk about some of the issues that were discussed at the July 2013 Interpretations Committee meeting, which was held on the 16th and 17th of July. Now, the views that you'll hear in this podcast will be those of the presenters and not necessarily those of the IFRS Interpretations Committee or the International Accounting Standards Board. First of all, we'd like to start with an issue related to IAS 32 and financial instruments. And this is to do with the classification of a financial instrument that is mandatorily convertible into a variable number of shares, subject to a cap and a floor, but which gives the issuer the option of settling by delivering the maximum fixed number of shares. Now, Liz, what is this issue about?
So the question is how an issuer of a financial instrument should assess the substance of a particular early settlement option in accordance with IAS 32. The Interpretations Committee received a submission that described an instrument that has a stated maturity date, and at maturity, the issuer is required to deliver a variable number of its own equity instruments to equal a fixed cash amount. But that variable number is subject to a cap and a floor, which limit and guarantee, respectively, the number of equity instruments to be received. The submission also noted that the issuer is required to pay interest on this instrument. But the feature that the committee focused on is that the issuer has the contractual right to settle the instrument at any time before maturity. But to do so, the issuer must first deliver the maximum number of equity instruments specified in the contract and also pay in cash all of the interest that would have been payable if the instrument had remained outstanding until maturity. So the committee's discussion focused on whether that early settlement feature should be considered when the issuer classifies the instrument.
And so the consequence of that early settlement feature would be what in terms of the classification?
So if it were included in the assessment of the classification, then many would agree, or most would agree, I suppose, that the instrument would be classified as an equity instrument because the issuer has the contractual right to deliver a fixed number of its own shares.
And so without that early settlement feature, we're talking about settlement for a variable number of shares, which would lead to a different classification.
That's right, although that outcome is a bit trickier, and we're aware that there's some diversity in practice. But the submission did express the view that without that feature, so if you were to ignore that feature, then the range between the cap and the floor indeed would create a variable number of shares with the outcome that the instrument would be classified as a financial liability.
So where has the committee got to in its discussions on this?
Okay. Well, the committee noted that IAS 32 requires the issuer to classify the instrument in accordance with the substance of the contractual arrangement. So if a particular contractual term lacks substance, it would be excluded from the classification assessment. So with regards to the instrument described in the submission, the committee pointed out that the issuer can't assume that the instrument meets the definition of equity simply because the issuer can settle the obligation by delivering a fixed number of its own equity instruments. But rather, judgment is required to determine whether the issuer's early settlement option is substantive and thus should be considered in determining how to classify the instrument. If that option isn't substantive, then it wouldn't be considered in determining the instrument's classification. So to make that determination, the issuer will need to understand whether there are actual economic or business reasons for including that feature in the instrument. For example, among other factors, the issuer could consider whether the instrument would have been priced differently if the issuer's early settlement option hadn't been included in the contractual terms.
Okay. So where have we got to now in the process on this one?
So on this one, the Interpretations Committee considered that in the light of existing IFRS requirements, neither an interpretation nor an amendment is necessary. So it tentatively decided that this issue shouldn't be added to its agenda, and this will be reconsidered at the November 2013 meeting. And I suppose one final note that's interesting is during the meeting, the Interpretations Committee asked the staff to analyze the accounting for a similar instrument. So that's a mandatorily convertible instrument that obliges the issuer to settle the instrument by delivering a variable number of its own equity instruments subject to a cap and a floor. So this is the same as the instrument that we've been discussing, except the issuer doesn't have the right to settle early by delivering a fixed number of its equity instruments. So as I mentioned a minute ago, it's that scenario which we're aware of diversity in practice. And the staff will bring that analysis to a future meeting.
Okay, that's good. Then we had a second question that the committee discussed relating to liability equity classification. And this was concerning a classification of financial instrument that is mandatorily convertible into a variable number of shares upon a contingent non-viability event. So what was that topic about?
Okay, so as you mentioned, this is another IS 32 issue. And the committee discussed the submission that asked how the issuer would classify a particular mandatorily convertible financial instrument. So specifically, the instrument did not have a stated maturity date, but was mandatorily convertible into a variable number of the issuer's own equity instruments if the issuer breached a Tier 1 capital ratio. So that's the event that was called a contingent non-viability event. The submission also noted that interest on this instrument is payable at the discretion of the issuer.
And what was the committee's discussions as regards to this classification?
So the committee noted that IAS 32, not IAS 39 or IFRS 9, sets out the relevant requirements for classifying financial instruments from the perspective of the issuer. So consistent with IAS 32, the instrument is a compound instrument with two components. First, there's a liability component, which reflects the issuer's obligation to deliver a variable number of its own equity instruments if the contingent non-viability event occurs. And the second component is an equity component, which reflects the issuer's discretion to pay interest. The committee noted that if the issuer is obliged to deliver a variable number of its own equity instrument, that obligation meets the definition of a financial liability. And IAS 32 goes on to say that a financial liability exists even if the settlement of the obligation is contingent on the occurrence of an uncertain future event that is beyond the control of both the issuer and the holder. And the committee noted that a contingent non-viability event is indeed beyond the control of both. To measure the liability component, the Interpretations Committee noted that the issuer must consider the fact that the contingent non-viability event could occur immediately. That's because it's beyond the control of the issuer, and there's no time period that must elapse before the event could occur.
So it's that possibility that it could theoretically occur immediately that is relevant here, rather than an expectation as to when it might occur.
That's absolutely correct. So the non-viability event is beyond the control of the issuer, and there's no time period that must elapse before the event could occur. So the liability component must be measured at the amount that the issuer could be required to repay immediately. And this is consistent with the requirements for an obligation that's conditional on the holder exercising its right to redeem an instrument, like some put options written on the issuer's own shares. And indeed, the basis for conclusions on IAS 32 discusses the ISB's view that a financial liability must be measured at the full amount of the obligation if the occurrence of the contingent event is beyond the control of the issuer. And as far as the equity component goes, that would be measured as a residual, and in this case, it would have a value of zero. Nevertheless, the committee noted that the equity component exists. So if the issuer pays any interest on the instruments, those payments relate to the equity component and would be recognized in equity.
Right, and that's because they're not contractually obliged to pay those interest payments.
That's exactly right. They're fully at the discretion of the issuer.
Right. So where have we got to now? What are the next steps?
So similar to the IAS 32 issue that we discussed a minute ago, the Interpretations Committee considered that in the light of existing requirements, neither an interpretation nor an amendment is necessary. So it tentatively decided that this issue shouldn't be added to its agenda. But this tentative decision will be reconsidered at the November 2013 meeting.
Thank you. So for our third issue, I'd like to ask Leo Piombino about the issues that were discussed relating to the actuarial assumptions, in particular the discount rate for employee benefits, IAS 19. Now, Leah, what is this? Is an issue that we've been discussing a few times before now.
Yes.
Where are we at now with these discussions?
Yes, thank you, Michael. I recap briefly the issue. According to paragraph 83 of IAS 19, the discount rate should be determined by reference to market yield on high-quality corporate bonds. The problem is that IAS 19 does not specify which corporate bonds qualify to be high-quality corporate bonds. The predominant practice, based on US GAAP, is to consider high-quality corporate bonds the bonds that receive one of the two highest ratings given by an international recognized rating agency, for example, AAA or AA. Because of the financial crisis, the number of bonds rated AAA or AA has decreased, and so the submitter asks the committee whether bonds with a rating lower than AA can be considered to be high-quality corporate bonds. As you mentioned, Michael, the committee discussed this issue several times. We started in November last year. In this meeting, the committee noted that the issue is too broad to be addressed in an efficient manner. Consequently, the Interpretation Committee decided to stop the project, issuing a tentative agenda decision. In this tentative agenda decision, the committee wants to highlight that the term high quality in paragraph 83 reflects an absolute concept of credit quality and not a concept of credit quality that is relative to a given population of corporate bonds. Indeed, the paragraph does not refer to highest quality, but refer to high quality corporate bonds. The committee decided not to determine the reference point for high quality. So the committee will not specify whether, for example, the reference point should be AA or single A. However, the committee wants to highlight that the entity policy for determining the discount rate should be applied consistently over time. So the meaning of high quality should not change over time. The committee expects the discount rate to change to reflect changes in time value of money, and not to reflect changes in credit quality of the bonds used to determine the discount rate. The committee thinks that a reduction in the number of high-quality corporate bonds should not result in a change to entity policy for determining the discount rate, provided that the relevant market in high-quality corporate bonds remains deep.
So the committee has limited itself to the current requirements within IAS 19 and given its view on how those would be applied in the current environment, given that there has been changes in the numbers of high quality corporate bonds that are available. And where you were talking about that they thought the issue was too broad to address, that was in the context of potentially changing the requirements. So they're not going to change, they're sticking with what it currently says and explaining how they see that should be applied.
Exactly.
And so where are we at with this now? This is the end of it, is it?
Almost the end, because we issue a tentative agenda decision, and as all the other agenda decisions, there are 60 days for comment period, and then in January, I think,
in November,
we will issue the final agenda decision.
Good. Okay. Now, Leo, there was a second issue that you were dealing with the committee that I wanted to ask about. And this is one that relates to IFRS 7 and some additional disclosures that were put into IFRS 7 recently. Now, these additional disclosures, the question that we've got here, as I understand it, is about their applicability, whether there's a requirement to give these in condensed interim financial reports. So what's the status of this? Where have we got to in terms of discussing this issue?
The issue exactly this one, because the submitter asked the committee to clarify whether the disclosure required by the amendment to IFRS 7, the offsetting disclosure, should be included in every set of condensed interim financial statement or only when required by IAS 34. The committee noted that IAS 34 was not consequentially amended upon the issue of the amendments to IFRS 7, and that when ASB wants to explicitly require an entity to provide disclosure in condensed interim financial statement in all circumstances, it amends IAS 34. Consequently, the committee recommended that the ISB should propose an amendment to IFRS 7 to clarify that the additional disclosure required by the amendments for IFRS 7 is not necessarily required in all interim periods. The additional disclosure is required to be given in condensed interim financial statement when its inclusion would be required in accordance with IAS 34.
Right. So these disclosures that relate to the offsetting of financial assets and financial liabilities, these are applicable from this year, from 2013.
Yes.
So companies that are preparing their condensed interim financial reports for during 2013, the committee's view is that these disclosures are required only when triggered by IAS 34, which would be, for example, if there were significant changes in the company's situation, that would mean that given that there's a change from year end, the company needs to give these disclosures.
Exactly.
And what are we planning to do with regards to this issue?
We are planning annual improvements. We will bring our proposed annual improvement to a future ISB meeting for approval. I think that we will include this annual improvement in the 2012-2014 cycle.
Right, which we're planning to publish the exposure draft later this year.
Yes.
Great, thank you. And our final issue to look at today relates to IFRS 10 consolidated financial statements and IFRS 11 joint arrangements, and a question concerning transition provisions and how those interact with impairment, foreign exchange and borrowing costs. Now, Patrick, what is the question that was asked here?
Yes, the submitter question relates to the first application of IFRS 10 and IFRS 11. The submitter observes that those standards provide relief from retrospective application in specific circumstances, but he also observes that neither IFRS 10 nor IFRS 11 provides specific transition relief in respect of the application, for example, of IAS 36, IAS 23 or IAS 21.
So that's the impairment standard.
Impairment.
IAS 21 is the foreign exchange.
Yes.
And then
23
is the capitalization of borrowing costs. Right.
Exactly. So, for example, if the consolidation conclusion changes when first applying IFRS 10 and an investor concludes that it should have consolidated an investee under IFRS 10 but and that investee was not previously consolidated under IAS 27, then this would have an impact on the composition of cash generating units when applying the requirements of IAS 36 retrospectively. And this would also affect, presumably, historical impairment tests of assets and goodwill in particular.
So, in fact, applying IFRS 10 retrospectively and consolidating something now under the new standard that you acquired several years ago would potentially require you to go back and reperform, or not reperform, but to perform for the first time, goodwill impairment tests, for example, from the date of acquisition.
Exactly, because you would have to include all sorts of assets of the newly investee that would have to be consolidated retrospectively. So as a result, the submitter thinks that retrospective application of IFRS 11 or IFRS 11 could be very problematic because of the fact that you would have to apply also retrospectively other standards such as IAS 36.
So what did the Interpretations Committee conclude on this? What were their views?
Well, with regards to IFRS 10, the committee acknowledged that when IFRS 10 is applied for the first time, you would have to apply also retrospectively other standards such as IAS 36, IAS 23 or IAS 21. But and in order to comply with the requirements of IFRS 10, you would have to apply those standards retrospectively on the date of transition. But it also observed that if retrospective application of the requirements of IFRS 10 is impracticable, as this notion is defined in IAS 8, then because it is impracticable to apply retrospectively those other standards such as IAS 36, then you would not have to apply the standard retrospectively because this impracticability exemption would apply.
And this impracticability exception is specifically set out in the transition provisions for IFRS 10.
Exactly. It is clearly written that if you cannot apply the measurement requirements that are included in the transitional provisions of IFRS 10 because it's impracticable, then you don't do it.
And that would apply not just to the basics of IFRS 10, but the requirement that if you're applying IFRS 10, you also have to apply these other standards.
Exactly. And that would mean that you would apply those requirements in IFRS 10 and consequential requirements that you would have to apply with respect to other standards at the first date when it would become practicable to
right.
do so.
Yes.
So what is called the deemed acquisition date in IFRS 10, for instance, if you have to consolidate something that was not previously consolidated.
And so where has the committee concluded now on this?
Well, it also made some comments about the retrospective application of IFRS 11,
yes.
because this is slightly different for IFRS 11,
right.
because the committee, with regards to IFRS 11, observed that definition of joint control has not changed. It's very similar in IFRS 11 and in old IS 31. So the committee thinks that the assessment of whether an investor would have joint control of an arrangement would be the same under IFRS 11 and under IS 31. So this would mean that the only changes that an entity would have when first applying IFRS 11 would be either to change from proportionate consolidation to equity accounting or from equity accounting to shares of assets and liabilities. And in those cases, IFRS 11 already provides relief from retrospective application. You don't have to reconstruct, for example, what equity accounting would have been if you apply retrospectively IS 28. So that means that with regards to IFRS 11, the committee does not expect that you would have any issues with regards to the application of those other standards.
Yes. Okay. So IFRS 10, it identifies the impracticability relief. IFRS 11, it doesn't expect there to be the same problems as you might get with IFRS 10. And so where does that leave us now?
So now the committee decided to publish a tentative agenda decision in the July FRIC update on the basis of this analysis. And interested parties, as always, will have 60 days to comment on this tentative agenda decisions.
Very good. Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of the podcast for the IFRS Interpretations Committee meeting July 2013. The full record of the proceedings of the meeting can be found in IFRIC Update, which is available on the ISB website. And just as a reminder that those tentative agenda decisions, and we've heard about four of those today, are open for comment for 60 days, and those comments will be considered and discussed at the Interpretations Committee meeting in November 2013. Thank you very much for listening.